Wonderful to be back with you tonight. In this series, in the Henry and Sadie Bayer Chumash class, where we've been exploring biblical commentaries. And tonight, I want to pick up basically where we left off last week. When we left off last week, Abarbanel had died in 1508 in Italy. So I want to pick up with the next generation, also in Italy, and I want to study with you a little about the Sforno, Rabbi Ovadia Sforno, who was born, we don't know exactly when, but let's say 1470, 1475 in Italy. So let me just say a few words of introduction to set the stage for what it means to be a Jew living in Italy at the end of the 15th, 16th century. And of course, I have to begin by saying that to use the word Italy is a total anachronism. Obviously, there's no country called Italy in the 15th, 16th century. What we have are city-states, you know, functionally in the area that we know today as Italy. And they function independently. By and large. I just want to zoom out for a second and say a couple of words about what it means to be living in this period. Okay, so generally speaking, we're in the middle of Renaissance, right? In the lifetime of the Sforno. I don't have evidence that he ever, you know, met them, but he was living at the same generation as Michelangelo and Titian and Da Vinci and Botticelli. And if you go across to the Met, you can see and meet all of the Sforno's contemporaries. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we think of Italy in the 16th century, you know, we think of the ghetto. So the ghetto is only invented in 1519. The first ghetto is in Venice, as you know. Most of the cities where the Sforno lived did not have a ghetto yet, to the extent that those locations ever did. They were really after the time of the Sforno, who dies, we think, I think we have the accurate date of his death, even though we don't know the date of his birth, 1470, 1475, until 1550, thereabouts. Okay, so Italy is a fascinating, right? We could spend, you know, weeks, months, semesters learning about Renaissance Italy and what it meant to be a Jew living in Renaissance Italy. Okay, so just a couple of pieces to give you a sense of how different the Italian Jewish experience is from the rest of the European Jewish experience. Okay, so it's a chiddush for Jews to be living in Italy, even though the reputation is that Jewish life in Italy goes back a long, long time. I say it's a chiddush because it's not obvious that they're permitted to live there. So, you know, every region has its own mishigas. Every region has its own set of laws. But by and large, Jews are only permitted to live in a given region if they've obtained some sort of special permission. And they sign these contracts. They're called condotte. And they restrict and limit the number of Jews that can live in a particular community, the length of time that Jews can live in a community. And this has all kinds of long-term and kind of really important consequences for Jewish life in these Italian city-states. So Jews don't own land. Okay, so before the 16th century, you won't find a shul in Italy. They just didn't exist. They didn't have permission to own property. They didn't have permission to build them. So, you know, a bunch of Jews could get together and daven in some person's house who had the space, but there's no shul. There's no mikvah. Historians and scholars like to debate whether or not this was a reflection of how observant the community was. We have lots of evidence that women were following the halachos of Jewish family life. They just didn't have infrastructure. So they'd find a river, you know, some natural body of water, what have you. But they didn't build mikvahs. Cemeteries was always, thinking of Parshas Chayesara. It's not obvious that, oh, you know, the Jewish community has its cemetery. It's in the back of the shul. No, they had to barter and beg and figure it out. And as a result of, you know, these rules, Jewish communities are very small and very diffuse. So, you know, you'll find questions that you don't find in other locations nearly with this degree of frequency. You know, we only have 8 Jewish men living in our community. 7 of us want to get together and create a little tax so that we can get 2 more people and have a minyan for Rosh Hashanah. But the 8th guy doesn't want to pony up. So do we have permission to levy a tax on the 8th? What a wild thing to think about, right? What kind of observant Jew wouldn't live in a community with infrastructure where, of course, there's a minyan and a school and a yeshiva? They didn't have it. It just wasn't possible. Okay, so this is the backdrop for the man that we're going to meet tonight. And I'm going to zoom out again in a minute to talk about the Renaissance and to talk about the humanist spirit that really pervaded this time period. Okay, so as I mentioned, Sforno is born, we think, around 1475. He's born in a little community, and again, that's always the case, even though Jews do live in some of the bigger cities. He's born in a little community called Cesena, and that's on the map that you can see on your source sheet. I'll try and pull it up here. Cesena is here on the map. It's just north of, you know, you could see San Marino, and it's a little north of Florence, south of Bologna. That's where he's born. And then the better part of his life, he spends in the larger communities of Rome and Bologna. So he grows up in Cesena. He's trained not just Jewishly, but he's trained in a very broad humanistic way, such that he's educated in mathematics and philosophy and literature and so on, which again, you didn't necessarily have in other parts of Europe at this time. He breaks in. We don't know the whole story of how this happened, but he breaks into a medical school. So, you know, on the one hand, there's all kinds of restrictions for Jews living in these Italian provinces, in these Italian city-states. And at the same time, there's also lots of opportunities to interact and take advantage of the wider Christian world that were not necessarily open to, you know, contemporary Jews living in other parts of the world. So to the best of our knowledge, he is the first Jewish graduate of the medical school in Ferrara, okay? Which is just an extraordinary thing to think about. Right? He's like a licensed practicing medical doctor, you know, the same way that his Christian neighbors could have gone to medical school and become licensed practicing medical doctors. So I want to share with you what I consider to be just a mind-blowingly remarkable document. Okay, I want to. We have this, and it's just astounding to me that we have this. I'm going to put it up on the screen. And I think you'll be the first people in our community to have ever seen this document before. It's on your source sheets. Here we have it on your source sheets. It's going to be on page 3. Okay, and this is the diploma. This is the diploma. It's in Latin, so it's never, to my knowledge, been translated. Okay, very few people have seen this and let alone translated it. So it's never, if you're good with Latin and you have a little time on your hands, I'll be happy to send you the rest of the document. But this is, as you can see, the diploma from the medical school in Ferrara, April 27, 1501 in Latin. Okay. And it's extraordinary that 500 and some odd years later, we still have this document.
Yeah, it is.
Fascinating to know what it says. And I'll just share with you one clip. In his medical school diploma, it says something to the effect of, you know, we had hoped that we would get him to see the light of Christianity, but we were not successful. Nonetheless, we're granting him this diploma because he fulfilled his requirements and so on. So Ovadia Soforno is able to graduate medical school in Ferrara in 1701, and he develops relationships with Christian Hebraists. He reads and understands Latin. He has interchanges with Christian clerics. And again, there's this tension because on the one hand, difficult to be a Jew living in Italian provinces in the beginning of the 16th century. And on the other hand, a really unique opportunity to be living in this time, in this place, for someone who's ready, willing, and able to take advantage of the opportunities that are afforded to him. So I just want to share with you a paragraph from one of the early histories of Italian Jewry, the very famous historian called Cecil Roth, one of the most famous Jewish historians in the 20th century. And he wrote a book called The History of the Jews of Italy. It was published in 1946. And I just want to share with you one excerpt to give you a sense, a little about, you know, Cecil Roth's impression of Italian Jewry at this time, and also to give you a sense of how the historiography has changed in the last 80 years since this was written. Okay, so just you have this on your source sheets on page 3. Okay, right above the diploma. This is the excerpt. Cecil Roth, for it must be remembered that the Italian's temperament is no less volatile than versatile. As recent years have demonstrated, it's writing this 1946, as recent years have demonstrated, he can easily be stirred up to a frenzy by an orator who plays on his sentiment, but these moments of passion cannot last for long. And when they are past, he reverts to his easygoing, indolent, friendly self. Sometimes a bloody riot might be caused by the inflammatory flow of rhetoric from the pulpit. But after the wave of feeling had ebbed, and the series of sermons was ended, and the friar had moved on to another city, the frenzy would die down as suddenly as it had risen. The Jew reached his broken windows, and the needy plebeian again began to bring along his valuables in the hope of raising money, and there would be laughter and singing and perhaps drinking in the streets. And somber ecclesiastics would once again begin to mutter at the excessive cordiality. And it would again be true that in no part of the world did such a feeling of friendliness prevail as in Italy between the people and the Jews. Okay, so already just, you know, it should strike us as a bit much, right, to think of just how, you know, idyllic Cecil Roth makes things out to be. Yeah, there might have been what we would call in, you know, Eastern Europe, a pogrom, and some, adherents to the Pope got all excited, and there was a riot and a little massacre, but then things got much better, and all of a sudden their carousing was back, and all was well with the Christians and the Jews living at this time. Okay, so obviously the reality is somewhere in between. And again, this is all just a way of saying that what a unique time and what a unique tension to be, you know, living with the constant fear that you could be expelled from your city state and you have no sense of protection, safety, or security. And at the same time, you could go to medical school, the libraries are open, people are happy to have exchanges with you to talk about literature or learning or Judaism or theology in ways that that one would have thought impossible in another time or another context. Okay, so most of the Sforno's life, you know, is not known to us. We don't have a decent biography of the Sforno. There's just not a lot more information. But we know that around 1525, he ends up in Bologna. He's not making a lot of money as a doctor. Most of his life, he's a teacher. It doesn't seem like He had a shul or a community of his own, but he did sit on a beis din. He was a teacher in yeshiva, and he became very prominent very quickly. People wrote to him and asked him halachic questions. He wrote a number of important commentaries beyond the work that we know of his commentary on the Torah. And I just want to say a word about something that he published, which will again just round out this picture. So in 1537, I put this on the source sheet as well. And you can see it, 1537, this is page one of the source sheet. He publishes a book called Sefer Or Amim. Okay, let me put it back on the shared screen. Okay, he publishes this book called Or Amim. And it's a book of, philosophy. And it's meant to be open to a wide audience to dispel some, you know, common misconceptions, according to the Sforno, about Aristotelian philosophy. He publishes it himself in 1537 in Bologna in Hebrew. And then, this is amazing, in 1548, he translates it into Latin, and he publishes it in Latin, okay, for a Christian audience. I mean, you can probably count on one hand in the pre-modern period, including the pre-modern period, maybe up until the modern period, how many rabbis published books for a Christian audience in the vernacular? Just stunning, right? Oh, to think of this accomplishment, and the book exists. You can check it out in the library. Okay, let me just ask everyone to mute if you are not muted. Okay. So this is an amazing book, and again, he's writing for for Jews, and he's writing for Christians. Okay, so let me turn now to some of the qualities and characteristics of the commentary that he wrote to the Torah, and then I want to leave some time to engage with his commentary itself on the Parsha. But on the way, we'll get a flavor for what his commentary is all about by looking at a number of other excerpts from various parts of the Torah. So first, and perhaps most importantly, one of the defining characteristics of the Sforno's commentary to the Torah is this sense of affinity for or sympathy for the humanistic zeitgeist of Renaissance Italy in the 16th century. So even in places in the text where there seems to be an emphasis on Jewish particularism, Sforno is always hitting the pause button and saying, yes, 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 this is very particularistic, but don't forget the Torah is also a universalistic text and there's a universal message as well. So I'll share with you a couple examples. Maybe the most particularistic text in all of the Torah, or certainly one of them, comes right before a Matan Torah. And the Torah tells us that v'atentiyum amlachas kohanim v'goy kadosh, and you're going to be an am segula. You're going to be a treasured people. Okay? So that's God speaking to the Jewish people. So what does the Sforno say, Johnny on the spot? So you have this in source number one. Yisem li segula mikol hamim. You're going to be the most treasured of all the peoples in the world. Afal pisha kol hamina enoshi yakar etzli. Right? This is the Sforno putting words into God's mouth. Even though all people are considered precious to me, mikol yesar nimtzaim hashfalim, more so than any other creatures in the world. Ki hu levado ha-mechuvan bahem. Kam ramzal chaviv adam shniv rabitzelem. We talked about this just last night. right? What Rabbi Akiva says in Pirkei Avos. You have to remember that all people are created B'Tzelem Elokim. So, right, Rashi's not quoting that Mishnah on this pasuk. Mikol makom atem tiyu li segula mikulam. Ki li kol ha'aretz. I've chosen you. So what does it mean? Right? What's the humanistic interpretation of a mamleches kohanim and an am segula? So you can imagine another perush telling us, the Jewish people have a special place in the world, and we have a special neshama, and we have a special mesorah, and we have a special heritage. Svorno says, right, this could have been, it's such a modern, maybe even postmodern notion. He says, ki likol aretz, v'hevdol b'nechem b'pachos v'yesarhu, ki amnam likol aretz v'chasidei umos ha'olam yikarim etzli b'lisafek. He says, well, whatever it is, I'm going to get to it in a second, but whatever separates you is, you know, a little more, a little less, but anybody could be from the Hasidei Umos Olam. They're all considered precious. The fact that you're going to be Kohanim, that's what makes you precious. You're going to be teachers. You have a special mission. What sets you apart is nothing inherent about you. There's nothing holier about you. There's nothing elevated about you. You Jewish people are just like all people. What makes you special is you have a special mission in this world. Again, this could have been written in 2020. This is such a modern conception of what it means to be chosen in the Torah. And you can just imagine, right, the breadth of the audience that the Sforno is writing this for. So this is you know, a perfect interpretation for the broadest possible audience, Jews, non-Jews, doesn't matter who you're talking about, anyone could feel comfortable reading this commentary and feeling as though it was speaking directly to them. So point number one is this sense of humanism that pervades the commentary of the Sforno. Point number two is another very important message that resonates a little with something we saw in the commentary of the Abarbanel last week, and it's the sense that God does not abandon Israel. And he always returns to this theme. You're going to be down, you're going to be low, there's exile, there's diaspora. And again, in some sense, you have to keep in mind that he's speaking to this generation. He's also watching, right? How did Abarbanel end up in Italy? He was expelled from the Iberian Peninsula. So you have refugees coming from Spain and from Portugal throughout the lifetime, the adult lifetime of the Sforno. He's watching, right, the end of the largest Jewish community in the world. So refugees of the Spanish expulsion, the Iberian expulsion, so they're also reading his commentaries, and he also wants to give them a sense of comfort, consolation, and hope. Things may be down now, but they won't always be down. In his introduction to the Torah, the Sforno writes, and this is point number three, that he's interested in explaining the Torah's chronology and organization. And apparently, and this is, you know, maybe part of a larger conversation, but apparently there was a sense among Christian scholars or contemporary Christian Hebraists that the Torah was somehow inferior to other books of antiquity because the Torah didn't follow a strict chronology. And from a literary metric perspective, Christians says, we're going to rate the Torah lower, you know, than Homer or something, because it doesn't follow a strict chronology. So the Sforno says, I just want to show you what it means when the Torah decides to deviate from a strict chronology, because it's not a history. I want to sharpen those connections and help people understand what the transitions are all about. And again, that seems to be coming from a quasi-polemical place against those who would claim that somehow the text of the Torah is not up to snuff because the transitions are not always smooth. As you know, Point number four, part of the Sforno's greatness is his capacity for concision. You know, he's the opposite of Abarbanel. Abarbanel, right, 50 pages to explain a pasuk. Sforno, one line, two lines, and we got it. And it's also important to put the Sforno in kind of historical context. You know, the ground has been, has the groundwork has been done. So, you know, Rashi was starting with nothing other than the text, right? There weren't existing commentaries other than what he had from the Gemara and the Medrash by and large. So he had to do all of the work. By the time the Sforno is writing, so he's already living in the advent of the printing press. Rashi's commentary has already been published. Ramban's commentary has already been published. Ibn Ezra's commentary has also already been published. Obviously, these things continue to circulate in manuscript even after they've been published. So the Sforno doesn't feel compelled to explain every word. If Rashi covered it, Rashi covered it. So the Sforno doesn't have to give you, you know, the first 400 years of medieval scholarship on every pasuk. He assumes that you've got that already, so that what he does is considered to be additive. He is a pshat oriented perush, and he says this quite explicitly, where he is able to produce an interpretation of the text without recourse to Medrash, he's much happier to do that. Okay? He knows the Medrash, he's deeply familiar with the Medrash, and sometimes the kernel of the Medrash's question, the Medrash's theory, sometimes that will get woven into the parish of the Sforno, but more often than not, his first priority is to interpret the text on its own terms, as we talked about, within its own context, without recourse to Medrash. And I'll show you in a minute a really conspicuous example of how that works. Okay, let me conclude with two last points about what characterizes and sometimes sets apart the commentary of the Sforno. Let me give an example of each. Okay, one is something that we've not talked about in the first three sessions. And that's something that medieval commentaries would call tamei ha-mitzvot, the rationale for the mitzvah. Right? This is a Maimonidean notion. Sometimes the Torah will tell you why a particular mitzvah has been commanded. More often than not, the Torah will be silent about why a particular mitzvah has been commanded. And there's a great medieval debate as to whether or not one should spend time and energy speculating about the rationale behind a mitzvah for which the Torah is otherwise silent. So the Sforno, and again, this comes back to his rational humanistic tendency, the Sforno wants you to know, you're the reader, here's a mitzvah, the Torah doesn't give you any rhyme or reason. The Sforno says, I'll give you the rhyme or reason. So I'll just give you one example, and again, there's many, but just so you could sort of see it in action. Okay, and this is source number two on your source sheets. Okay. So, the Torah has pidyon chamur. So sometimes there's an obligation to redeem the firstborn, and sometimes it's a firstborn child, sometimes it's a firstborn animal. And the Sforno says, what is this all about? The chamor of all animals, why would that be something that we would need to think about or give a special designation to? So the Sforno says in source number two, what's special about the donkey of all animals? He says, I'll tell you, b'chosek yad hotzianu Hashem mitzrayim, b'chosek yadam shel mitzrayim hotzianu Hashem. So God took us out of Egypt with great force, against the force of the Mitzrayim. Ke'amro v'tichazek mitzrayim ala am, ba'ofen shelo yechonu laseis nechsinu ba'agalos k'minhag mitzrayim. We were forced out. Okay, it wasn't a pleasant scene when we had to leave. We had to leave in a great hurry, and there was all kinds of commotion. And normally, if we were moving, we would have had wagons to transport our stuff. Sforno says, but we didn't have that. And so we had to load all of our belongings onto donkeys. That's the burst, that's the beast of burden. And that's what was available to us. And in the quality or in the quantity or in the capacity or in the ability, it was a miracle that even without wagons, we could manage to get all of our stuff onto these donkeys. And the fact is that we commemorate that miracle with the notion of redeeming the firstborn, v'chal aleihem ezer kedusha re'u l'fidyon, right? And the redemption somehow signifies that miracle. So you could take it or leave it. My point here is not to convince you that this is the reason for this particular mitzvah, but just to demonstrate that this is an interest and an ongoing one throughout the commentary of the Sforno to give you the rhyme, the reason, the rationale behind mitzvos that are otherwise open. The last point I want to make, and then I want to turn to our Parsha for a few minutes. The last point I want to make about some of what characterizes the commentary of the Sforno is to place the Sforno in opposition to the commentaries that we've seen before with respect to troubling episodes in the lives of the Avos. So if you remember, the Ramban and Abarbanel are basically on one end of that spectrum. And Ramban has no problem telling you, Avram Avinu Chata. It wasn't intentional, but there are times where Abraham made a terrible mistake and he sinned. And Sarah did something terrible, she shouldn't have done it, and she sinned, right? And on and on and on throughout Sefer Bereishis, throughout the Torah, Barbanel basically adopts a similar approach. We have no compunctions, Ramban or Barbanel will tell you, about reading the text of the Torah as it's presented to us. You don't need to clean it up. If the Torah tells us someone who's otherwise a biblical hero made a mistake, so be it. They're human beings, and the heroism of these human beings is that they learn from the mistakes and they do better the next time around. Rashi, has a pretty sophisticated and nuanced approach where he'll often signal or indicate that something is wrong, but also provide some means by which to read the text that doesn't force us to see a particular person in that kind of light. The Sforno is at the other end of the spectrum from Abarbanel and Ramban, which is to say, he wants you to read the text and see the heroes of the Torah as heroes. And if there's a problem, he'll identify it, and he'll do his best to explain it and interpret it such that the text makes sense, but the lives and the integrity of the characters can be maintained. I want to give you just one example. It might be the most original, comment in the entire commentary of the Sforno. So turn to your source sheets. You have this in source number 3. Okay, so we're in Parshas Vayeshev. This is, we'll get there in a few weeks. This is the beginning of the Yosef story functionally. And as you remember, Yaakov has dispatched Yosef to go visit his brothers who are shepherding their flocks in Shechem. The brothers see Yosef coming, and they hatch this plot, and the rest is history. And on its face, it's a very upsetting text. I mean, these are the sons of Yaakov, the Shiftei Ka, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, and they sell their brother into slavery. What a terrible story! What a terrible story! How do we make sense of this? Okay, so if you're the Ramban, the Abarbanel, it's a terrible story. They committed a terrible sin. They should never have done it. It's terrible. Sforno says, you've misread the story. Let me explain to you what happened here and the rationale behind the actions and behaviors of Yosef's brothers. Pasuk Lamed Zayin, Perek Lamed Zayin, Perek Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Yudfes. The Torah says, Vayiru oso merachok. This is a lot of pronouns here, right? They saw him. The brothers saw Yosef from a distance. Uveterem yikrav alehem, and before he could approach them, and he was just coming in the distance, they saw him. Viyisnaklu oso lahamiso. So I put an English translation here. 98% of, you know, translations will translate it this way or in a similar way. Before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Difficult word. Vayisnaklu oso lahamiso. They plotted to kill him. Okay, and then the rest of the text makes perfect sense because that's exactly what happens. Sforno says, no, that is not what the text means. Let me tell you what this pasuk is all about. In the interest of time, maybe I'll just show you a few highlights from source number four. He says, "Hinei lashon akel yore al ham tzaal hara kemo asher niflula." So you have to understand the grammar of this word. They plotted. That's not what it means. It is amar shechashvu as Yosef belibam nuchal lehamis. What it means is they ascribed to Yosef the potential or the capacity for murder. They thought that Yosef was somehow capable of murder. It wasn't that he was coming to, ask how they were doing, right? Which is what Yaakov had asked him to do. What he was looking for was dirt. He was going to find some information on them that he was either going to report back to Yaakov Avinu such that Yaakov would punish them, or such that somehow God would punish them. B'yishar hu levado baruch mibanim, so that he alone would be left as the blessed among the children. So skip down to about the fifth line, the middle line. Uvazehu dia mahaya lamo bios kulam tzadikim gumarim ad shiushmo sam lifnei Hashem lezikaron. Eich nu adu lev yachtav larogis achihem ulamachro velo nachamo al hara. He says, this has to be the interpretation. Who are we talking about here? These are perfectly righteous people. These are the sons of Yaakov. Their names are on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. You're going to tell me that they're sinners who sold their brother without justification? It can't be. There must be a justification. The justification is that they thought he was going to somehow be responsible for their death. He says, and if you go on, right? The proof is in the pudding. You fast forward, Yosef has thrown them in the pit and they say, this must be happening to us. We're so guilty because Yosef was screaming. We didn't listen. The Sforno says, even when they have a guilty conscience for what they did, they never feel guilty for having sold him. They feel guilty for not having been more compassionate when he was in the pit. Somehow he was out to get them, either in this world or the next, or both. You know what that's a reference to? That's a reference to the concept of rodef. If someone is breaking into your house, if someone is out to get you, you have to kill him first, right? You have an obligation, or certainly an allowance or a dispensation for a preemptive strike if someone is on the attack. And so the whole thing is justified. You can read source number five. He says, you know, they sat down and had lunch. The Torah says, 2:7 psukim later. What is that about? He says, the only way that could have happened is if they had no sense of, they have no sense of shame because their actions were totally justified. What are you gonna tell me? They sat down and had lunch. Were they sociopaths? They have no conscience. They have no remorse. They have no regret. No, the only way it could make sense for them to sit down and have lunch after having sold their brother is if it was totally justified because he was out to damage them. He was out to injure them. He was out to harm them. And their preemptive strike was completely justified in the eyes of the Torah and the eyes of Allah. Again, take it or leave it, but a fascinating reworking, reinterpretation of a story that we probably thought was just patently obvious and couldn't be understood in any other way. Okay, let me actually just pause here for a second to ask if there are any questions or comments, and then in the last 15 minutes, we'll spend a little time looking at Sforno's commentary to our parsha. Okay, you know, I had a Rashi joke, I even had an Abar Benel joke. I have to confess, I don't have a Sforno joke, but I want to thank Scott Fisher because he alerted me to something very important this morning. There's a new restaurant on 88th and Broadway. It's called Sforno. O-R-N-O. It's a pizza restaurant, okay? It has nothing to do with Ovadia Sforno. It has nothing to do with Italian Jewry. It's not a Jewish-owned restaurant, to the best of my knowledge. It's not a kosher restaurant, okay? I thought maybe I'd go in there and say, Sforno, you could be, but I don't want, you know, our local establishments are struggling enough. They don't need to compete with another kosher pizza restaurant that has a better name than any of them. So you should just know that Sforno, I looked it up, so it has nothing to do with this topic, but Forno, you know what Forno means in Italian? Think of the word Inferno. So Forno means an oven. So means like out of the oven. So the pizza is an oven. Out of the oven. So next time you're walking down 88th Street, don't go into Sforno and buy the non-kosher pizza, but do remember the beautiful commentary written by a man called Ovadia Sforno in the 16th century, and you know, put on a podcast, and you could learn a little Torah next time you pass by Sforno restaurant. Okay, any questions or comments? I'm sorry, that was the closest I could do to a Sforno joke. There's also a wine now called Sforno. That's for another conversation too. Why did the wine industry start naming all of their wines after commentaries to the Torah? Rashi, Abar Benel, Sforno. Okay, we'll have to figure that out. You know, someone said, maybe Rashi was a vintner. Maybe, we have no idea what Rashi's profession was. Sforno was a doctor, right? He didn't harvest grapes. I'm not sure why he got a wine named after him. They should name a medical school after. Okay, so let's jump to Chayesara. We have a few minutes left. I want to just give a taste for the Sforno's commentary to the parsha. Chapter 24, Perek Chav Daled. The reason your source sheet is so long is because I put in the whole perek, so it would be easy to reference in case anything came up. It's the longest perek in Bereishis, the longest perek in the Torah. It's the story of the Eved Avraham Eliezer and his mission to find a bride for Yitzchak and his success in that mission when he returns to Be'er Lachai Roi with Rivka on a camel. Okay, so very long chapter, 67 verses. I want to share with you a Gemara, which is a commentary and explanation to the very first pasuk of the chapter. Hashem, Avraham zaken baba yamim. Avraham was old, baba yamim. He was very old, something like that. Hashem beirachas Avraham bakol, and Hashem blessed Avraham bakol with everything. Okay, so Hashem beirachas Avraham bakol. So, what does that mean? What does it mean that Hashem blessed Avraham with everything? Okay, so let's learn a Gemara together. You have this in your source sheets on source number six. So Gemara in Bava Basra. I'm not going to put it on the screen, just in the interest of time. But the Gemara has seven explanations, basically functioning as midrashic explanations. Seven explanations for what it means that Hashem blessed Avraham with everything. Okay? You ready? Hashem be'erachas Avraham bakol. My bakol. What does that mean? Rabbi Meir Omer Shelo Haisa Lo Bas. You know what it means? The blessing was he didn't have a daughter. What does that mean? It means, right, Rashi says if he would have had a daughter, it would have been like a terrible struggle for him to find someone to marry because, right, in ancient times, the household is sort of, patriarchal house and it's going to be governed by the man. So was he just going to marry a pagan? Like, how would that work out? So maybe the blessing was that he didn't have a daughter. Shelo haisa bas. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, shehaisa lo bas. The opposite. Maybe the blessing was he had a daughter, and that's considered to be, everything. That's the great bracha. Acherim omrim, another possibility. Bas haisa lo Avraham. Yeah, he had a daughter. Ubakol shema. And her name was Bakol. You could be named Mikol. You could be named Bakol. Okay, I don't know people with the name Bakol, but Gemara says, Avraham had a daughter. Her name was Bakol. Rabbi Eliezer Modai Amar, Omer Itzdaganinus Haisa Belibo Shavra Mavinu, Shekol Malche Mizrach Umar Mashkimu Lepischa. Somehow Avraham was a great astrologer. People would come from far and near to hear his astrological interpretations and forecasts. Kol, right? Everyone would come running to his tent. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Amar, Evan Tova Isla Tuluya Bitsavarosha Avram Avinu Shakol Chola Roa Sombiad Misrape. Avram had some kind of special stone coming hung around his neck. People would come from far and wide. If you'd see the stone, you'd be healed. Bakol. Davar Acher Shalomerit Esav Biyamav. Sixth interpretation. You know what it means that he was blessed with everything? The blessing was, Esav, his grandson, went off the derech, but he didn't see it in his lifetime. He died before he had to witness his grandson going down a different path. Final answer, davar acher she'asa yishmal tshuva b'yamav. Or, what bakol means? What gave him the status quo was everything? Yishmael did tshuva in his lifetime. The fact that Yishmael did tshuva, is almost explicit in the psukim because he's right there when Avram dies. So obviously he came back. But the fact that he did tshuva in Avram's life, so you could see your son return, that's considered to be bakol, that's considered to be everything. Anyone remember which of these Rashi chooses? Rashi chooses none of these, actually. Rashi chooses a different medrash. And Rashi says, Bakol, what's the gematria of Bakol? Just shout it out, put it in the chat. 52, you know what else is the gematria of Bakol? The word Ben. What it means that Avraham had everything is that he, after all this time, had a son. He was blessed with a son. That's what it means that he had everything. Okay? And so Rashi flows very nicely with the continuation of the text. Avraham is blessed with a son. So now, what do you do for your son? You find your son a bride so that he can get married. We understand the continuation of the story. The problem is, what does the rest of this narrative tell us of relevance? Okay, and here's where the Sforno comes in. So what are the clues? Go back to Perak Chafdalet Pasuk Aleph, Avraham Zaken Baba Yamin. Avraham's very old. We know that already. Right? What would Abarbanel say about this pasuk? I didn't look, but he would surely say, why does the Torah have to tell us? He said, we could do the math. So Avraham's old. Hashem somehow blessed Avraham with everything. What's the relevance of that? What does that mean? And now, Vayomer Avraham el Abdov, Zakan Beisam, Hashem b'chol asher lo, Simna yadcha tachas yerechi. And now Avraham doesn't just dispatch Eliezer on this mission, but he makes him take a solemn oath that what's he not going to do? You could find anyone you have, but make sure it's a girl who's not from around here. Okay, in 21st century America, we call that an out-of-towner. Okay? You have to marry someone from out of town. So what is that about? Why is the shvua necessary? Why a solemn oath? What's happening here? So listen to the interpretation of the sforno. You can see it in source number 7. The Avraham Zaken Vashem Beirach, Be'er Hasibos Shechricho es Avraham Nishlalach Asavado El Eretz Acheres, Ba'ad Asher Lubno, Be'shehutzrach Lahashpio Olav Shari Lesibos Hazikna, Da'ag Sheyamus V'lo Yire Bechupas Bino. He says everything here, every piece of information here, is the rationale for why it is that Avraham had to take these steps and for why it is that Avraham took them in the way he did, why he dispatched his servant, and why he made his servant take an oath. He says, reason number one is Avraham is very old, and very old people don't live forever. So Avraham is worried, da'ag shiyamus, he's worried that he's gonna die. V'lo yireh b'chupas b'no. And such a reasonable, rational, this is what parents think about. You want to be able to walk your kid down the aisle. And the older someone gets, the more this weighs on them. They think, am I going to live to see the day that my child will be married? So Avraham wants to see it. He's getting older. His child is not married. And so the fact that he's old is what's compelling him and propelling the story forward. B'skim shelo la'acher od. Right, and he resolves not to wait any longer. And because he knows that no child of a pagan in his land, in the land of Canaan, would be acceptable for his daughter, he has to dispatch his servant to a foreign land. Oshro, what's Vashem Beirachas Avraham Bakol? Just take the text literally, man. If the Torah tells us that Hashem blessed Avraham with everything, it means he blessed Hashem with everything, right? You ever hear people say, I have it all. So what do they mean? They mean that they're not lacking for anything. So, and if you've been reading the story up until now, you know that Hashem has blessed Avraham with great wealth. How many times does the Torah have to tell us from the beginning of the narrative, right on, you know, throughout? That he's constantly described as being a man of great means and great wealth. So he says that's the rationale. You ready for this? It's not in the text at all. The Sforno says, let me just give you the rational explanation. What happens to people who are very prominent or very famous or very rich? People want to associate with them, and they'll do anything to make that association. So the Sforno says, you know what my theory is? My theory is that this was actually a very precarious mission for Eved Avraham, for Eliezer. Because Eliezer is going to put up a classified ad that says wanted spouse for son of Avraham Avinu, and he's going to get all kinds of requests, and he's not just going to get requests, but someone's going to tap him on the shoulder, and slip him a 50, and say, can you put my request at the top of the pile? Sforno says, what's to prevent anyone from bribing this man such that Eliezer would consider the proposal of someone unworthy and accept it for ulterior motives? There's nothing decisive that Avraham can do to prevent that from happening, but the thing that's within his power is the shvuah. He can insist that Eliezer swear. Take an oath and promise me that you won't let this happen, that you'll find the right bride for my son, you'll bring him back, and we will have the happiest ending to this story that we can possibly imagine. So here you have no recourse to the Medrash, right? The Gemara, seven wonderful potential explanations. Oh, Sforno rejects all of them in favor of just reading the text within its context. Here's what we know, and from the text itself, we can divine what is happening in the parts of the text that are more opaque or less clear. We're just about out of time. If you're interested, I have a few other highlights in sources 8 and 9 from the Parsha. But I hope that we've at least developed a little bit of a sense for the rationalism, the cogency, the lucidity, and the humanism of this extraordinary commentary, which has endured for 500 years. The Sforno didn't live to publish his commentary on the Torah in his lifetime. You can see on the first page of your source sheet, I have the first edition of the Sforno's commentary on the Torah and some of the other books of Tanakh, which was printed a number of years after his death, died in 1550, was finally published in Venice in 1567, and it's been a bestseller ever since. So I wish everyone a wonderful rest of the evening. As I mentioned at the beginning, I hope that we'll see you twice next week, Thursday night for this section, the fifth installment of the commentaries. And a week from Thursday, a special cooking class in honor of Parshas Toldos. We'll be cooking lentil soup, just like Yaakov and Esav, and grape leaves, which again, a midrashic interpretation. No, I'm just joking. I don't have any evidence that anyone cooked grape leaves.
Well, it's from Bereishit. Weren't there grape leaves?
There must have been grape leaves. There must have for been. Sure in Gan Eden. Yeah. There's no question.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Yessi. Thank you.